Hi, I'm Jay from JinxNavigator.com, and this is my podcast. We're making our way through all the issues of The Jinx. That's a newsletter for magicians and mentalists that lasted from 1934 to 1941, and a lot of what we do as mystery performers can be traced back to something from The Jinx. This is the podcast where we browse through every issue and find out how many of those ideas are still usable. Spoiler alert, the answer is just about all of them. We're looking at issue number 15 today, which contains the editorial by Theodore Annemann, an original faked envelope with a publicity angle by Theodore Annemann, a different card spelling by George C. Hanneman, an original ball dropper by Ottokar Fischer, and Diabolical Influence by Harris Solomon. The editorial in issue number 15 opens with a photo of Otis Manning pulling off what Annemann calls a super example of spontaneous press coverage, a three-column picture on the front page of a city daily. Annemann doesn't have Manning's permission to print The Secret yet, but promises full details next issue. Gene Gordon stopped through Waverly, New York with his traveling school show and apparently made Annemann feel very unnecessary with his thought of card variations, cards that were never physically selected, but were found anyway. Gordon also passed along a lobby display idea, paint the magician's eyes in a promotional photo with luminous paint. After dark, when the lobby lights go out, those eyes keep glowing from whatever street light is nearby. Annemann calls it a thrill or a chill, depending on the person. There's a quick item about a stage mind reader whose crystal ball act has a secret layer most people would never guess, a backstage assistant who is a handwriting expert, sending out not just the questions, but personal notes about the questioners. Annemann finds this angle so promising, he mentions that the performer is considering leaving stage work entirely to focus on private readings with it. He also makes a practical point about business cards. Whenever you write something down during a trick, a prediction, a name, a number, write it on your own business card instead of a blank slip. People keep those. It's a walking advertisement that connects the memory of the effect to a name and contact info. And I have seen Joe Diamond do that exact thing. Then there's the expose question, which Annemann returns to. His position is that formal expulsion from magical societies doesn't work and never will. The exposer walks in, does a few good card tricks, and suddenly he's everyone's best friend again. His proposed remedy is the silent treatment, not rudeness, just steady social ostracism. Stop inviting the person. Stop asking to see their tricks. Make them feel, without a word being said, that the community has moved on without them. He describes watching this fail in real time at a meeting where a known exposer walked in and was immediately surrounded by people wanting to see his latest stuff. Annemann's point is that magicians would rather watch a good card trick than enforce an ethical principle. He closes with a pointed question about Eddie Cantor, who had recently appeared in an SAM show while simultaneously running a radio promotion that gave away magic books as premiums. Annemann wonders whether the society might have made a stronger statement and gotten better publicity by politely declining his appearance on ethical grounds rather than welcoming him to the stage. Yes, Annemann was hardcore. This first effect is from Annemann and is creatively named an original faked envelope with a publicity angle. It's a refinement of the faked envelope, a tool that shows up throughout the mentalism tradition, and that Annemann has clear opinions about. His opening point is worth noting. He's never liked using a faked envelope in a way that makes the envelope obviously the center of attention. This makes a lot of sense. If a card goes in and a different card comes out, the audience focuses on the envelope as the agent of change. But if a freely chosen card is sealed and later revealed to be correct, there's no obvious reason to suspect the envelope at all. The container disappears from suspicion. The envelope he describes here has three compartments, two of which can be preloaded before the performance. Depending on which end is trimmed with scissors, when the time comes, a different compartment opens and a different paper falls out. Nothing is pulled out by hand. Nothing requires fumbling. The contents simply dumped into the helper's palm. So you have a three-way out envelope if you include the original card or paper you put in the envelope. Otherwise, a two-way out. He describes using this during a local election, writing a prediction, sealing it, having the newspaper editor sign across the face, then apparently having a second thought, crumpling the first envelope and sealing a new one. The crumpled envelope went into his pocket. When the results came in, he returned to the office, the prediction was verified, and he left the signed envelope, the original unprepared one, on the table while pocketing the faked one. Clean entry, clean exit. You want full details on that? It is at jinxnavigator.com. This next one, a different card spelling, is from George C. Hanneman, and it's a refinement of a spelling effect he found in Gibson's Houdini's Magic. The original trick works like this. A helper selects a card, then counts through the deck spelling out the name of the suit, one card per letter, and lands on a card of the same suit. They keep going, spelling the value, and land on a card of the same value. Two separate revelations, both arriving exactly on cue. Hanneman's issue with the original is a practical one. It required calling jacks knaves and twos deuces, terms that might play in England but feel awkward to American audiences. His version rearranges things so that standard American names work throughout, ace, two, three, jack. He also expands the selection from seven possible cards to eight, which gives a little more apparent freedom to the helper. The setup requires 19 cards in a specific order near the middle of the deck. Once that's in place, the trick essentially runs itself. The helper spells their suit, lands on a matching suit, spells their value, lands on a matching value. No sleight of hand needed. Hanneman also offers a handling for those who'd rather avoid a force entirely, allowing the helper to genuinely think of any of the eight cards before removing it. Full details are at jinxnavigator.com. An original ball dropper is Ottokar Fischer's third contribution across issues 13 through 15, and it's a piece of apparatus rather than a performance effect, a device for secretly obtaining a ball during a routine without any telltale movement. The dropper pins inside the coat near the lower edge. The ball sits in a small fabric holder, and retrieving it requires nothing more than lowering the arm slightly and pressing gently with two fingers. Gravity does the rest. The ball rolls into the bent fingers, and the arm comes back up with the ball palmed. Fisher's specific note is that the hand should stay completely still during the retrieval. No fidgeting, no sudden movement. Done right, the ball can be obtained even while moving briskly, and the dropper lies flat against the body once empty, leaving no visible trace. This thing reminds me of my performances 40-some years ago. My jackets had so many non-jacket items in them. Pockets for doves, cards pinned on the left, vanishing candle on the right, a giant card pinned against the inside breast pocket, and so on. Oh, the good old days. The diagram in the original issue shows the construction of the ball dropper, and you can see that at jinxnavigator.com. This final effect, Diabolical Influence, is from Harris Solomon, and Anneman's introduction calls it one of the most barefaced swindles to cross his path in some time, which, coming from Anneman, is pretty good praise. He says he worries readers will think it too simple and miss the point. Here's what the audience experiences. Okay, follow along here. The performer takes a card from the deck, writes something on its face, covers the writing with a gummed sticker, and has someone write their initials on top. That card goes face down on the table. A helper selects and pockets a card from the deck. The performer leaves the room. From outside, he directs the proceedings. Someone calls out a number, counts to that position in the deck, and remembers the card. Someone else names a random card. A third person calls out three numbers between 1 and 100. Now, all this is written down. The performer returns. He turns over the stickered card, the prediction made before any choices were made, and it correctly names the card at the counted position. Two more cards are turned over, matching the other selections. The three numbers are added up, and the sum matches what was written under the sticker. The pocketed card is named, the deck is shown complete, all 52 cards present. The method involves a duplicate deck and a window of time out of the room that's doing more work than it appears to. Anneman calls the overall effect the best parlor and drawing room conception he knows, and I'm going to try this one. Full details at jinxnavigator.com. That's it for this episode of the Jinx Navigator podcast. To see every article in every issue of the Jinx, go to jinxnavigator.com and sign up. It's completely, absolutely free. Use the contact form on the site. Let me know what you think of the podcast and the Jinx Navigator site, good or bad. I'm Jay Jennings from jinxnavigator.com. And I hope you join me again next time when we explore issue 16, which includes Again a Prediction by Doc Mifflin. And I thank you in advance for helping spread the word about this, the Jinx Navigator podcast. See you next week.